Hey friends, welcome to the Rhythms for Life podcast, where each week we talk about four rhythms that help you reduce stress and anxiety and take charge of your emotional health. Rest, restore, connect, create. This episode is brought to you by Samaritan Ministries. Walking through a healthcare event affects us emotionally, spiritually, physically, and financially. But you don't have to walk alone. Samaritan Ministries connects you with other members who support you through prayer, encouragement, and financial support for your medical need. This is one of the many joys of being a Samaritan member. Samaritan Ministries is a healthcare sharing ministry with over a quarter of a million Christians that care for one another's medical needs, all without the use of insurance. New members are always welcome at Samaritan Ministries, and you have the freedom to join at any time. Gabe and I have benefited so much from this type of a sharing plan because it really does feel like there's a community caring for one another. Discover the joy of healthcare together at SamaritanMinistries.org/RFL podcast. Hey guys, I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Gabe.
We're so excited that you're here today, and I'm super pumped about today's conversation with Seth, a dear friend.
Yeah, we're getting into addiction and how not just addiction to the classic things that you might think people are addicted to, such as alcohol or pornography or
drugs
or whatever, but the actual common addictions in all of our life. And the discussion we're going to have today, I mean, Rebecca and I are going to reveal and get into some of the things that we've found ourselves addicted to,
right,
that we've had to work through. And we're doing it with somebody who's an expert at this, not only because he's thought about it a lot, but he's actually lived it out.
Right. For 7 years now, he's walked the road of sobriety coming out of alcoholism. And his first book, Coming Clean, in 2015, chronicled the first 90 days of sobriety. And today we'll talk about the things that are practical, ways to approach quiet, and how that actually starts to reveal, what are we addicted to? It's so subtle. You know, it could be anything that feels good and we enjoy it, but in the end, if it actually is an escape or a numbing, that's when we know we need to pay attention to it.
Yeah, I want to get into just how do we know those lines of the things we enjoy? Because obviously here we're talking about these rhythms. We want to have great rhythms in our life that bring us pleasure and help us come alive. But when does it become too much? And when are we distracting ourselves? And so there's nobody better to talk about that than Seth. And his book is called The Book of Waking Up, Experiencing the Divine Love That Reorders a Life. He's such an interesting character too. I mean, he's
right,
a lawyer, family man with children.
A writer. Spiritual director.
Yeah.
He's really just like, smart.
So he's like the perfect person to help us, I think, really get into what is going on inside our hearts, in our feelings, but then practically, what are we going to do to move forward in health?
Seth and I have had this similar narrative of reordering a life, remaking a life, reestablishing a life. And so we were writing our books together, actually, Rhythms of Renewal, and he was writing the Book of Waking Up. And we would, you know, just talk to each other or text. And he's like, I had to stop what I was doing and go take a walk to unlock that creator's block. And he gives a nod to rhythms in his book in the same way I talk about it, how that actually breaks that cycle of compulsion or the things that we're just numbing out to, because these rhythms are very intentional. And he shares that here in today's podcast.
So we invite you to just sit back for a little while. We're going to have a longer conversation with Seth, and we really want to help you unpack. And we hope it helps you start to just unpack some of these areas that maybe you've not thought that much about, but after today, you'll start to see in a new light. Let's listen in now.
Hey, Seth, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today. I've been waiting for this discussion for a while now.
I am so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we did have breakfast together this morning,
which was awesome.
I made you some great farm fresh eggs, right?
The two best eggs I've had this week.
Oh, what I love about when Seth comes to town is all kinds of great, deep conversations. I feel like you're a brother to both Rebecca and I. And so we can really dig into each other's lives. You ask really penetrating questions that help us think a little deeper than maybe we already are. And so I'm excited for everybody today to just get to know you better and to hear your story. And man, I know Rebecca and I have benefited so much from your willingness to be transparent about the journey you've been on when so many people just decide not to talk about it. And because you've exposed it, you're helping so many of us.
Right. You are also a smarty pants, but you don't make us feel dumb.
Oh, that's really kind. I don't know that I'm that smart. Maybe you're super smart.
Well, no, but you talk about things in a way that are approachable and relatable because you're honest. Mm. And your story is very compelling. And I know so many people have something similar. It might not look like alcohol, but everyone has an addiction to something, whether or not they're aware of it. And yet you have unpacked this over the last 7 years, even with your story of coming clean in your first book. So would you give the listener a little context for why you became, you know, such a voice in this area?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I was raised in a very stable, solid, non-drinking, teetotaling sort of home. But when I got into the professional world, I started to just socially drink. I mean, what I found was I had a real aptitude for it. Like, everyone was created to do one thing really well. For Gabe, it might be like throw a football or dunk a basketball. For me, it was drink.
So you were really good at drinking.
I was quality. Like, I was to drinking what Michael Jordan is to basketball. That's what I...
Wow. Did that's you what I make like the say. Drinks? Did
you, no, I just drank them.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I was only good at drinking them.
Okay,
yeah, so it was very social. But then I had a season where my youngest son was really ill. And in that season, we actually thought for a while we were going to lose him. And when that deep sort of existential pain set in of, God, where are you? Why are you not healing my son? Why are things, you know, seeming to go downhill so fast? I just decided I couldn't feel, didn't want to feel anymore. I mean, that's a big loss.
How old was he at that time?
It was right before his first birthday.
So this was his first year of life.
Yes.
That 1 year
made
it spiral for you.
Yeah. And particularly it was the season between his 6 month and his first year when we had been praying so much for him and seeing no traction. And as a result of that, just this deep, deep pain set in. And so I decided, you know, I didn't want to feel anymore and I was just going to drink the pain away. And that's what I did.
So then when did it come to a head for you that you realized, hey, this is more than a social thing? Who did you invite into that? How long did it take you to even realize that?
Yeah, so about a year after he was released from the hospital, he did end up making it. That's the good news. But for that next year, maybe 12, 13 months, I drank really, really hard. And in that period, Amber, my wife, would ask me over and over again, hey, are you sure you don't have a problem? Do you need to maybe cut back? And it wasn't until, you know, a full year later that I was speaking at a conference on orphan care and human care in Austin, Texas. And a woman had just moved from Minnesota to Austin. I had no idea. I knew her from writing circles, and she had a story of sobriety. And I was nursing this terrible hangover in the middle of an Austin Methodist church, and the doors open and the light sort of like comes in like shards, you know, when you have a hangover and it just kind of tears your brain apart is how it feels. And I see this silhouette, and when the doors close, there she is. I recognized her and I walked over to her and said, how did you know you had a drinking problem? And she just looked at me and said, you know, don't you? And that was the thing that kickstarted this journey into sobriety.
When I hear that, you know, as a person who hasn't struggled with alcohol addiction, I think sometimes I used to think, well, that's just a problem some people have. And how does that really relate to me? And I think what you've helped me uncover in my own life is this idea that I think you're kind of becoming famous for, the statement that mm-hmm. we're all addicted to something. Mm-hmm. And the obvious thing could be, you know, a porn addiction, or it could be an alcohol addiction. And we can easily just kind of write it off and go, oh, those people are struggling with something, and not actually look at our own addictions to mm-hmm. distracting ourselves from our pain. And I think that's where you've gone so deep. And when we talk about rhythms for life, I think the big idea is it's hard to live into rhythm when you're nursing like a toxic shame and you're trying to cover that up and you're not trying to think about it. And it's just, I mean, let's be honest, it's a lot easier not to think about these things. It's a lot easier to just kind of fill our time with just fun and distraction. And I think what I've become awake to is that I distract myself a lot from the serious pain that I feel.
Yeah,
I love that we're going here because you said you were good at drinking before Titus was getting sick. So did this sobriety season require you to go back, 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 back? where that root of pain maybe began, yeah, or just having, I think for a lot of us, we know we're kind of numbing out. Mm-hmm. We know we're kind of trying to avoid those things, but we don't know why.
Yeah.
We don't know where it began. We don't know what the root is. What were some of the things that was revealed to you? Your first book was called Coming Clean.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure the listeners understand. And you chronicled your first 90 days of sobriety journaling. And
That's
then
right.
that became a book in 2015 that came out and released and had huge impact, won all these awards. So if you guys don't have that, grab it. But what you did, though, what would you tell the listener right now about how you had to actually go back way before and say, where was the root of this compulsion? Where did it come from?
You know, before we kind of kick off into the process of that, I use this quote from an addiction specialist named Gabor Mate, who works with heroin addicts. And in his book, it's called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. It's an amazing read. Mate says that the question for the addict is never why the addiction, but why the pain.
Right.
Okay. So when I started to come out of this just inebriated state, this constant inebriated state, I actually went to a therapist. And the therapist said a couple things. One, I don't want you to go to AA just yet because you're going to have to find a higher power. And you have so much pain in your life right now that I'm afraid you won't find your higher power. And if that happens, it may actually deconstruct your faith. So just pause for a minute and come visit me every week for 90 days, which is what I did. And as I went into that process, we found very early on that I was not able to organize my thoughts and I was not able to organize my pain. Because why? I had been avoiding it for so long. And so he said, what I want you to do is every day, as best you can, carve out some time of solitude and silence and get alone and begin to ask yourself the questions that I ask you in therapy and begin to journal your way through them. And because you're a writer, journal them as creatively as you can. And there was an added benefit to that too, which was he said, I don't understand anything you're saying. You're so discombobulated and disorganized when trying to talk about this pain that I can't give you any advice. So we're gonna do this in a very methodical, creative way. And so for me, every night I have this chair. It was in the corner of my room. It was a big, blue, straight-backed armchair by a fireplace. And I would sit there and just begin to think through and invite God really into the pain and saying, like, this hurts, but I don't understand why it hurts. I'm not drinking, so my nerves are on fire. I'm going through withdrawal. And all of these connections are starting to come. And what I found as I went back over the years was that, yes, the pain of my son was unbearable. It was a certain type of pain. But that was a pain that I've actually experienced my whole life. Mm. It was the pain of asking God for something and getting a no.
Wow.
It was the pain of constantly feeling like my faith wasn't enough because I was praying and things weren't happening, or because other people were praying and things weren't happening. And so it was this constant feeling that my prayers weren't enough, that I wasn't enough. And I
So how did you see God?
It's distant,
from that vantage
cold.
Point, yeah.
If even existent. There's a line in Coming Clean where I wrote, my greatest fear is that God is either capricious or nothing. Mm. And that was a deep pain. And that pain went all the way back in my life. I could pinpoint it as I started thinking, when was the first time I thought that? And it takes me all the way back to my childhood when I'm an asthmatic and I'm taken to a faith healer. And he tells me, if you have enough faith, you can be healed. And of course, I wasn't healed. We all know how that story plays out for so many people. And in that moment, the pain narrative of scarcity, that there's never enough, there's never enough faith, there's never enough action, there's never enough money, there's never enough anything, that's the moment that the pain narrative set in. And once I knew it, because I wasn't distracted, to your point, Gabe, I could then really start to deal with it and invite God into it.
So you just mentioned these pain narratives. And I think that's been something really clarifying for me, that so much of our addiction and the root of why we go to these places as sources of distraction or to make us feel better momentarily, mm-hmm. it comes from these deep roots. Could you kind of describe the three different areas that are these sources for pain? Because I know for me, when Rebecca, she was reading your new book and she pulled this up and she's like, which one do you think has been the source for your pain? And I was kind of like, I don't know. What do you think? And it actually, she helped me understand what mine was.
Yes, your new book, The Book of Waking Up. When I read this part, it was transformative for me. I've probably taught it now about 10 times, and I give you credit.
Thank you.
Because it's so clarifying, I think, right now. A lot of us know there's pain, but it feels like a big black cloud.
Yep.
And we're not connecting the dots as to why we tend to go towards this bent. So explain real quick the three narratives of pain and then the lies that go with them.
Yeah. So one of the things that I found as I traveled and spoke a little bit on coming clean was that people would say either I don't have any pain, or they would say, I know that I have some sort of pain and I'm using, you know, painkillers or shopping or porn or booze or the internet, social media, whatever the thing is, to sort of numb it, but I can't pinpoint what it is. And so the real challenge for me as I spoke and then as I decided to write about this was, how do we help people identify their pain so they can actually stop, get in the solitude and the silence, invite God into it, and then find healing? And it occurred to me as I thought about all the stories of addiction that I'd heard, and as I heard about all of the experiences that these people had, who were very transparent with me, it occurred to me that there are really like three types of pain that kind of kept coming up over and over and over again. And it was embedded in the language, it was embedded in the experiences, and those three types were scarcity, which is what I had. It was the pain of scarcity. There's never enough. That's the lie that scarcity spins, the narrative that it tells. There's never enough. Loss. So you think of the loss of a job, the loss of a spouse, the loss of a son or a daughter, and the narrative that goes along with that. The narrative that loss tells us is you're always alone. You'll always be alone. And then the final one, and this is a really tough one sometimes when you're speaking, is abuse. And the narrative that abuse tells you is no one is safe, nothing is safe. And it occurred to me as I walked through this process that every type of pain can be wrapped up in one of those three buckets. And then if we begin to think in those buckets, we can quickly begin to identify, oh, that's it for me, and then get back to the source of the pain.
Right, which then leads us to why we need that dopamine hit. In whether it's loneliness or not enoughness or no one is safe. And so we're going to get into that because you talk about the whiz bang. Like, your language is so fun, you know, like you're tackling a really hard topic, but you're talking about it in a way that is inviting. It's not scary or overwhelming or daunting. It's approachable.
And it's not capricious.
Yeah, it is. And it is there.
So for example, when I read scarcity, there is never enough, that unlocked something for me, because I do think that is a lot for me on the realm of there's never enough achievement.
Yeah.
There is never enough. Like if you're a 3 on the Enneagram, like that results, that performance, mm-hmm. all that, because somehow that validates worth. And then it's like, why do we have a workaholic? Cause there's never enough something.
Right.
And for some, it might be money. For some, it might be recognition.
Yep.
For some, it might be impact, influence,
yep.
whatever it is. It's like the scale and the trajectory always has to be up and to the right, or your life is considered insignificant.
Yeah.
And I never connected the dots that it had something to do with a pain point, that there was a never enough. But then I was able to start to look back and go, oh, this is why I have heard that narrative, actually, that narrative of scarcity. And that made a lot of sense. And then, you know, talking to Gabe about it, like, you know, for all of us, that fearful piece, you know, abuse might be seen as something dramatic, but it could be as much as neglect.
Yeah.
You know, it could be abandonment emotionally, whatever. It doesn't have to always mean like physical or sexual abuse, but it could be some lens of that that goes like, I don't feel safe. Maybe, you know, that fundamental question a child always asks is, who can I trust?
Yes.
And if that question wasn't answered in those primitive years of, you know, trying to have that attachment form, then there is a loss of safety there that continues into adulthood.
So I'm the classic case of, I don't have any pain.
Yeah.
I never had a bad childhood. Everything was great. I don't know why people spend so much time focused on all this negativity. And I think over the last few years, that's where I've awakened to the fact, okay, no, you didn't get out of jail card free, and you actually do have these pain points that you've just learned how to really cover up well. And that's been my journey of work, of trying to uncover that pain. And that's where the statement of safety, like that's the one for me, is no one safe from some sense of abuse that I'm not prepared to fully get into right now, but that I really uncovered later in life. And I think it's starting to help me now see how that plays into a lot of what I do, is that I want people to be safe. Yeah. I want them to know that there's a place that they can be comforted, that they can be known, that they can be protected from things that are coming at them from all directions that they don't even realize. So it's really helped me start to uncover that. And I've got a lot more work to do, but I'm so grateful that you've helped make it simple.
Yeah. Well, and here's the tricky part about what you both just said. Like, you both just touched on the idea or the notion. I'm not saying that you're workaholics, but you just both touched on the notion that perhaps work could be the coping mechanism that you use. Yeah. For you, it's work to achieve, to get more, to be seen as something that's more, to be seen as something that's, I don't know, that
well, this,
you have worth.
This need for significance,
I think,
which can be driven out of scarcity.
Yeah, so that could be, so again, it's still, it's in this work space, right? For you, it's the same thing. It's still work. It's still potentially workaholism, right? But it comes from a different underlying root pain, and it's this pain of abuse, of no one is safe, and so I'm going to give double time to making sure that people have safe places. And this is why I think those narratives are so important, because if we go to just attack the behavior without getting under the behavior and looking at the source of the pain, then we'll begin to do things that look like prescriptive plans to overcome workaholism. Well, those may work great for you, but they may not for Rebecca, because Rebecca's not getting her underlying need for significance met through those. Just quit work. Just call it off at 5 o'clock, you know?
Right.
And so we really have to dig underneath the addictive piece to get to those pain points if this is going to make any sense and we're going to find holistic healing.
And I think where, for me, you know, I think earlier in my career, maybe there was a little more of the workaholism thing. I think what I've experienced in the last, let's say, 5-6 years, is just purely finding things to distract myself with. It could be hobbies, which, I mean, are good. Like, that's what we talk about, rhythms. We need to have these. But sometimes those taking a higher priority so that I'm not feeling pain, or I'm not dealing with something more significant. I'd rather play golf. I'd rather hunt. I'd rather, you know, be out in nature and or playing sports or watching the NFL, right? Yeah. It's like all these things you start to realize, holy cow, our entire life is built on distraction. Our entire world and economy runs off distraction, and us not having the quiet solitude space to reflect, because, oh boy, once I have to do that, now I'm having to feel that pain. And I just think, I know for me, I just didn't realize I was even doing it.
Yeah.
And so the first step has been, okay, I'm starting to see all the ways I'm distracting myself. That's step one. Step two now, let's dig in and start to feel your pain.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Yeah.
Well, you talk about this in this book of waking up, because really you're not condemning the gifts of the giver, right?
No.
The gifts of being out in nature, right? Enjoying beauty, movement of your body, or like you were saying, Gabe, what you love about, you know, even just being in a deer stand is like early in the morning, watching a sunrise, it's silent. You can kind of just be alone, you know, in solitude with
or
God.
Or bread and wine,
right?
Another gift, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So we're not saying that these things are bad things. It's more to just acknowledge, like, one thing of just being present and acknowledging your communion with God in all those things, right?
Yes.
So unpack that a little bit about, because I think some people will feel like, okay, then all these things are bad. I can't do all these things that might distract me, because then that makes them bad. But that's not what you're saying. It's more about your mindfulness in recognizing where am I getting my source of security, of comfort? Is it the thing, or is it the one who creates the thing?
So this is where I think going back into the language of Orthodox Christianity is super helpful to me. And it's the language of sacramentality. I won't unpack all that here.
Just define that, though.
Yeah.
Define sacramentality.
But what that means is that things are given to us as a tangible manifestation of God's grace. Like, the created things are given to us. Does that make sense? As a means of saying, like, hey, here I am. Enjoy the world.
Yes.
It's, right.
Yeah, his lavish gifts to us, his creation.
It's I believe that I shall see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living, right? We get the goodness from things like experiencing his goodness in nature, walking in nature shows us, oh, he created this tree, this flower, this blade of grass, knowing that I would see it mm-hmm. and that I would find joy in it. You know,
right.
He created bread and wine to nourish us, to sustain us. And when we eat it, our brain lights up and says, whoo, this is good stuff. Let's do this again. So he did that so that we would have pleasure and so that we would say, oh, thank you, God, for drawing us into your goodness. I think a lot about sexuality because to me, this is the big one, right? Like God wanted to partner with us in the creation of the world. He wanted us to have a hand in that. And so he gave us pleasure so that we would say, oh, making babies feels good. Let's do that more. You know, let's have more babies. Let's partner with God in the creation of the world. These are the ways that our brains are made to work. But in every one of these instances, it's meant to draw us back to God. Your golf swing may or may not have anything to do with drawing you back to God. But in fact, I might argue sometimes it's an impediment. But being out in nature and that competitive drive and succeeding, achieving, these are things that God wants us to feel in our partnership with him for creation of a beautiful world. And so, yeah, I'm not saying get rid of the things. What I am saying is to the extent that we treat the things as the end, the wine is the end, the sex is the end, shopping is the end, gambling, for instance, as the end. When we reflexively reach for those things as the end to solve our pain or to numb our pain, then we're starting to operate in the realm of addiction, bad habit formation,
yeah, and those
dependency
become,
attachment.
They just become counterfeits for what really we could experience, which
That's
is much richer, much deeper. I was reading a book recently talking about sexuality in that way and how much we can tend to move towards sensuality, where it's actually enjoying physical touch, liking that experience, but only doing it for the physical touch of it versus the intimacy that God actually designed this for, that you can only know when you're in deeper, intimate relationship and fully known and fully naked from a spiritual perspective and an emotional perspective. And I think that's what you're getting at. And for some people, this is maybe the first time they're hearing this kind of thing. It sounds a little deep, a little like, man, I got to analyze every single thing. and the truth is, you know, a little bit, but I think this is the entire point of what you've written recently. And it's called The Book of Waking Up.
Yeah.
Is your entire point is, hey, let's just wake up to what's happening. We're a little in a slumber. We're not maybe noticing some things. And if you start to notice, God will meet you in the noticing and help you walk through it. And I want people to get to hear a little more about how you've walked through that, like what this journey has been like, because you're now 7 years into your journey of sobriety, and you're helping others now become sober, but not sober just from alcohol, mm-hmm. sober from all of our addictions. So mm-hmm. help us and the listener understand a little bit more of like, what does that journey look like?
So in my sobriety journey, I stumbled across this notion of attachment, and not in the sort of psychological sense, but more in the spiritual formation sense. And I stumbled across the work of St. Ignatius of Loyola, 500 years old. I mean, this stuff has been around forever. But he talked a lot about ordering and having disordered attachments or disordered affections. And what he meant by that was exactly what I was talking about earlier, loving the thing as the end instead of letting it draw you through to God. So instead of it being God first, wine second, it's wine first, maybe God somewhere, you know? So he was saying we need to get the order of our attachments back together. We need to reorder things. And one of the things that he wrote about on food and wine was really helpful for me, that brought it out of that sort of like esoteric realm and made it really practical. And he wrote on food and wine that food and wine are things that are sort of prone to lead to attachment, to addiction, to habit, to vice. And he said, so when you go to the table, imagine in prayer, imagine Jesus and his disciples at the table with you, and then eat as he would eat and drink as he would drink. And in that moment, it struck me, oh, I'm supposed to eat and drink as Jesus would eat and drink. He would enjoy food. He would enjoy wine. But he would enjoy those things only to the extent that they drew him through to the other side, that they drew him through to perfect connection with his Father. He would enjoy the best of, right? But he would also enjoy in moderation. And then there are some of us who, like, we don't need to enjoy some things in moderation anymore because we've burned those bridges,
right?
And so there are some people who need to say, you know, I don't need to enjoy wine as Jesus would, but I can look forward to the day when I can.
Well, when you look at the Last Supper and the communion he had with his disciples, knowing that this was the end and making sure they knew everything, you know, he wanted to share more of his heart, serve them by washing their feet. So not only was he connecting with the Father, like the end was the connection with them as well. Yeah. You know, just the embodiment of going, we're here together. This is an important moment. And I think for us as a family, you know, when we eat, we could stand around the kitchen island and just shove food in our faces. Or we could all sit down at the table, make sure we hear and listen to each other, ask questions. That connection and belonging piece mm-hmm. is so vital. All of a sudden, the food does become secondary. While it's still delicious, the primary is, do I belong here? Am I known? Am I loved? Are my thoughts and emotions held dear by the people in my family or my friendships? In the end, that's so much of what we're really craving is that intimacy and that communion.
Yeah.
One way I think that I've challenged myself based on reading this book is for a lot of us hearing this and you're going, okay, how do I psychoanalyze maybe all these arenas of my life that I enjoy? The way you can know is the thing numbing me out or is the thing actually waking me up? That's why it's the book of waking
100%.
Me up. Ta-da. So the escape, is it an escape?
Yeah.
Or is it actually fostering connection, belonging, creativity? Is it bringing me back to life? So, for example, you use things and you say all the things that help you escape create these dopamine hits. Would you explain that for a minute? You call it the whiz bang.
Yeah, the whiz bang. Yeah. They cause all these great chemical rushes, right? So when you eat, your brain releases a certain amount, a certain type of a neurochemical that says, this feels good. Whiz bang. Yeah, it's just like, whiz bang, this feels good. Let's do this again. When you have sex, same thing. When you get on social media and connect with others, even if it's not a real in-life connection, there's still this sort of whiz-bang chemical rush that happens. And interestingly, that's not just around connection. It's also around principles of gambling, which we don't have time for, but it's all in the book and it's super fascinating to me. But in every one of these events, these things that we need to sustain life, we have this rush of chemicals and then the brain dumps another neurochemical called dopamine. And the dopamine locks in the message, this felt good, let's do this again. So for instance, when I was a kid, the place where all of my scarcity, thoughts, feelings, mentality went away was at my grandparents' house. My grandfather had more money than we had. He was comfortable. There was always good food. I didn't drink at that time, but there was always good wine. I mean, he was just a man of large appetites, as the "Oh brother, where art thou" line goes. But every night, at the end of the night, when I was at their house, I would eat cereal, and my brain locked in the message that this is a safe place, this is an abundant place, this is a good place. And to this day, 42 years old, when I have a rough day at the office, when the money's not coming in like I thought, or the business isn't going like I thought, or you know, for whatever reason that scarcity itch comes up, guess what I do at the end of every night?
Cereal,
Frosted Flakes,
that's right,
Cocoa Puffs, Fruit Loops.
Yes, and yes.
Like, okay,
whatever's there, I do it. Lately,
how many bowls though?
Just one, and it's little. But I was actually talking to a friend. He's a fellow writer, and he has the same kind of itch. And he was talking to me about it the other day and saying, like, when you wrote about that, it was actually a little bit of an indictment. And for him, it's actually out of control. Like, it's two or three bowls at the end of the night. And I said to him, you know, I don't think that there's necessarily anything wrong with reaching for the bowl of cereal at the end of the night if it brings you comfort. You know, God wants us to have comfort. But what I told him is, again, if the reflex is to go there and stop there and not sit and meditate, and not sit and pray, and not sit and think through your day, and not do a full examine, then you're actually using it as a stopping place instead of allowing it to draw you through to contemplation and meditation. And so I think that's ultimately the question is it bad that we get these whiz-bang rushes? Is it bad that dopamine locks in these messages? No. But if we're not using the materials in this sort of ordered way to draw us through to silence, solitude, meditation, spiritual reading, connection with the divine love of God, then we really are disordering our attachments.
I think so many people don't know where to begin with that because we're so used to distraction.
Yeah.
All day long, mm-hmm. we have distraction. Why would we want silence? Let's just keep the noise up. Let's keep even music on so many levels, while it can be very healing, can also continue just to be a distraction. Like the silence requires some sort of engagement.
Yes.
It just forces that yeah. because all of a sudden the silence becomes deafening and we don't know what to do with it. I have worked hard lately. I actually haven't even worked at it. I've needed it. When no one else is in the car, I don't play anything.
Yeah.
And normally I've always wanted podcast, music, whatever. But that's been my time because we have six in our home. Mm-hmm. There's always somebody around real close to me and there's a lot of volume. I don't know if I'm just getting old because I know my parents used to do this too and it drove me insane, like turn some music on. But
right.
for me, it's been a time to just go, God, let's just chat on the way yeah. to work this morning. And I want to thank you for some things and I want to own it out loud so that I'm conscious that I'm doing it.
Yes.
It's not just kind of getting locked
yes.
in my brain. And it's almost transformative to have that interaction. I think partly we just need to give people permission to go, like, you can actually reflect in a journal. You can talk out loud if nobody's around. Like, you can get those thoughts out so that they're not in a loop, so that as you speak them, they kind of reveal something.
Yeah, and I think that's a large part of the work that I'm doing right now is just saying to people, like, oh, you don't know your addiction? Oh, you don't know your pain? Have you tried silence? And the answer often, over and over again, is no, I don't even know where to start with silence. Like, when do I find time for silence and solitude? I get up and I run until I go to bed. And what I'm trying to convince people is if you're actually going to do this work of inner sobriety, of like finding connection with the divine love, then you have to fight for silence. And I have a weekly rhythm. I begin my week with an hour of silence every week. It's the same rhythm, you know, hell or high water. You can find me at the same place for 1 hour in silence.
And what does that look like? And also explain what you mean by divine love.
Yeah.
And so, what kind of music do you play during that hour?
And what podcast do you listen to?
Wait, what? I Typhoon. Typhoon's Offering. That's what I listen to, which is an amazing album. Just saying, by the as an aside. No, so for me, every Monday there's a local chapel, and it's an adoration chapel at my local Catholic church. I go in there for an hour. I typically share it with three or four people. Nobody says a word. No one greets me. I greet no one. We sit there in silence and we pray and we tend to this idea of the sacramental love of God in our midst, among us. And when I talk about the sacramental love of God, that's what I actually mean by the divine love, that everything that has been given to us and is created for us is a means of interacting with God who loves us and wants us to experience pleasure. And this is, again, this is one of those concepts that goes back 500, 600, 700 years in Christian writing, that the love of God is not just like the love that we have for each other, I love you, but it's this deeper, fuller, complete divine love. And it is my experience that in American culture, if we are going to connect with that, we have to get away and carve out times of silence. We have to do it intentionally and we have to fight for it. And so I have my Monday morning ritual to connect with the divine love in silence. But then throughout the week, I'll carve out 10 minutes here, 30 minutes there. And it may be different based on the day, but it's always in my journal. Like, I always plan for it.
So what does temptation look like for you now?
This is like you're now in the confessional. You brought up the Catholic church. I mean, now Rebecca's playing priest.
There's kind of a screen between us two because of this massive mic cover. So, what does it look like? It looks like a lot of things. Like, I just launched this book 6 weeks ago. And in that 6 weeks, I found out that I had to be on all these shows and I had to write all this stuff and I had to be on Twitter and on Facebook and on Instagram promoting the work. And I knew that time was coming, but I wasn't super prepared for the promotion cycle that goes along with a book. And after about 2 weeks, I found that not only was I using social media as a tool, but I was using it as a drug. Mm-hmm. Like it got its hooks back into me. I was so frustrated, right? So to me, even as we talk, what is the temptation to reach for my phone to
right.
see if people are talking about my book, to see if people are doing, you know, liking stuff that I've done on Instagram, whatever the thing is. But then also, book buying. It's a big one for me. Like, I love information.
Yeah, Gabe showed you an old historic book last night.
He ruined me last night. I went down a 1 hour bunny trail, you know, after we when I was going to bed last night.
There are worse vices, but
there are worse.
I mean, some people hoard cats.
Yeah, so I don't hoard
cats.
I
think books are probably
you're
a little better.
That's
probably
better.
Yeah, that's right. And I can expense all of them.
But listen, this is the. I think you're making the exact point. Of course, buying books is great and good. But for you, you've recognized in that process, you became awakened to the fact that buying books is maybe a place you go instead of like dealing with some pain. And that's the depth, I think, that we're hoping all of us can consider as we look at our habits. Where do we go when we feel pain? And what a great example of that.
Yeah.
In the social media piece that you just acknowledged, I think so many people obviously wrestle with that. That's one of the primary things I write about in the renewal book of tech detox, because once you get those hours back and they could possibly go towards silence, these things all come to the surface.
That's right.
When you think about that connection you had with your readers in those first couple weeks, that was a positive, right? Like you were connecting,
absolutely.
You were hearing that it was resonating, that was a good thing. Where does it become where it kind of gets its tentacles on? Because that's to me as a writer as well, you know, like we're online and we write and we get away and we retreat to actually write the work. But then we eventually engage the world again and go, hey, I hope this is beneficial to you in the way it has been to me. And then people will share those responses. And I'm trying to, just like you, figure out what's healthy about it. And then when does it become healthy and why and how? It's so subtle.
It's so subtle.
What is that?
So, I mean, again, just because we're writers of faith doesn't mean that we're not susceptible to the same brain manipulations that everyone is.
Right.
Right. Like we're just as susceptible to the manipulations of Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. These algorithms work on all of us for a reason. Mm-hmm. And I love receiving email and Twitter notifications and Instagram notifications about my book. I love it. It makes me feel like, okay, the work that I've done is worth doing the work.
Right, exactly.
So there's a piece of that I love where, again, I go back to where it becomes less of a point of connection, more of an addiction, is when we reach for it as a reflex. Like, I don't feel good right now, and so I want to go see if anyone's talking about my book on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Instead of being really intentional and setting parameters, like, okay, my time to be on social media is between 12 and 12:30 and 4:30 and 5. Or whatever those parameters are to say, like, I'm carving out time, I have parameters. I'm not going to get sucked into the algorithms because I've planned this. And when you go into it with a plan, you can begin to say, okay, God, as I go into this, you know, protect me, like make sure I don't do something or say something stupid, but also like help me to see this as a way of expressing goodness and receiving your goodness.
Right.
And I think if we can approach all things that way, again, imagining Jesus and the disciples at the table with us, then we can actually enter into these spaces with sobriety.
So what are the motives for engagement?
What are the motives? Yeah.
I think, I know Rebecca's book, Rhythms of Renewal, meant a lot to you and
it
that
did,
process of trying to unpack these four rhythms. But could you just, in closing, share a little bit about how the idea of rhythms can help other people as in the same way I know it's been helpful to you.
Yeah. And I will say, and this is shameless Rebecca promotion instead of shameless self-promotion. Is that right? I think everybody should get your book. When I first walked through some of these concepts with you, my immediate thought was like, these are the anchors that the world needs. These are the anchors that we all need. And I think that these are anchors that people of faith need, that atheists and agnostics need. I've had amazing conversations with atheists and agnostics about your rhythms, because this is the way we've been designed. We need these rhythms. We need ways to stop and ways to connect and ways to create. We need ways to be engaged with God in the world. So for me, I daily have a particular startup rhythm that I do every day. I get up in the morning, I make a glass of water, I sit down, I don't even read the scriptures first, I turn to writing first. I try to unlock my brain, get my wheels turning. So I'll drink my water, write my words for the morning, then go get my cup of coffee, then sit with the scriptures because my mind is open now. My creativity's kind of unlocked me. And then that's when I turn to my silence, my solitude, my prayer, my scriptures. And it's the same every day. And these rhythms keep me really focused and doing the work that I need to be doing.
I was inspired to do that through the Artist Way, those morning pages.
Mm, yeah.
What kind of things do you write about first thing? Is it just a brain dump? Is it talking to God? Is it, what's your approach?
Yeah.
On that?
So for me, part of what I'm trying to do right now is get in. This is kind of cheesy, but not cheesy. This is actually audacious. I wrote a novel that I want to rework.
Of course you did.
All right. And it's about 5 years old now. And so I really want to rework it. And so I wanted to get into the rhythm every day of having a set time that I'm going to crank out words no matter what. And so for me, I decided I'm going to publish something every day on my blog, every day. And I do it at roughly the same time, unless something gets in the way, every morning. So I'm writing a short something to post on my blog every business day of the week. And that's hopefully, you know, building this habit in me so that when it comes time to go to rework the novel, it's just right there.
How do people find your blog to get your...
SethHaines.com.
Well, we're so glad you spent time with us. I know I'm looking forward to off air hearing about that glass of water you make and how you make a beautiful glass of water.
It's wonderful. So, I actually put a hydration tablet in it, so I cheat a little bit.
Is it reverse osmosis, though?
I don't know. I don't even know what that means.
Well, listen, we're grateful for what you've done to help so many of us wake up. I think it ultimately is about us becoming human again.
Yeah.
Remembering who we are, who we're designed to be. When we come at life from that place of strength, we can live out rhythms, and they help us keep that cultivated and help us flourish. But if we don't deal with this deep sense of pain and understanding that more and feel those feelings, it's these rhythms just kind of can cover it up.
Yeah.
And so we're grateful for all you've done to do that deep work and to share it with us.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Love the work y'all are doing.
Seth talks a lot about his morning routine, and I love how he talked about just the writing initially. And of course, he's working on a novel. Of course he is. But I share a lot about my morning routine in the Rest Rhythm. And the idea, I think, for all of us is that first hour sets the framework for our day. It really does establish if we can be a people that are more mindful in everything that we do. My morning routine literally looks just like four things. It's this idea of prayer and journaling and scripture and gratitude. Everyone's going to have a different approach to this, but I outline this in Rhythms of Renewal because I do think when we start to shift the way we begin the day, everything else changes. It impacts everything that we go out and do.
Yeah, and the tech detox idea. I mean, essentially, what I love is just hearing how other people are finding a way to take back their day, take back their time, give priority to the things that really matter and bring life and not just distract themselves. I know for me, the morning routine is a little harder because I literally walk, it might be 5 a.m, but there's this temptation. Do I read the news? Do I read the Bible? Do I pray? You know, and if the phone's nearby, I'm very tempted to go towards news. If I keep that phone in the closet plugged in, then I'm much more likely to go to something that's going to rejuvenate my soul versus just be more clutter and more information. So that's something I got to work on.
Well, part of it is that question right when you wake up, do I consume right now or do I reflect and pause? And the temptation will be to consume because we almost don't really want to think about anything that might require a little reflection because reflection usually reveals a need. And yet, I think if we can just share our need first thing to God, like, hey, let's remove yesterday and let's like start fresh. There's a new mercy and a grace for today. I do have need for you, God, and I want to make sure I show you that so that you can fill me instead of burden me with what news will bring, right? It's a different way of beginning.
If you're enjoying this conversation with Seth and you really want to dig into how you're going to start to set up this rhythm of spending your mornings the right way, we want to recommend to you the Abide app. The Abide app is the number one Christian meditation app. And to meditate, it simply means to dig in, to take the time to better understand something and to spend time focused on it. And the Abide users are reporting less stress, lower levels of anxiety and depression, and better sleep. And couldn't we all use a little bit of better sleep? So for a limited time, Rhythms for Life listeners will get 25% off a premium subscription when you visit abide.co/life. That's abide.co/life. Now, Abide's meditations, they start at 2 minutes long. They're easy to fit into your schedule, and they feature topics like overcoming anxiety, managing stress, addiction and recovery, finding forgiveness, and much more. So we encourage you to get into this. Check out the Abide app. Take advantage of this 25% off premium subscription by downloading the Abide app at abide.co/life.
We have so many new listeners that have joined us for season two. And I just want to make sure that you know that this Rhythms for Life podcast really did come from this idea of this Rhythms of Renewal to trade stress and anxiety for a life of peace and purpose. And the four rhythms that we talk about every week are rest, restore, connect, and create. And there is one rhythm that comes most natural for each of us. It's the one that we do naturally. It's most effortless. And because that's a dominant rhythm, I just created a quiz for anyone to figure out what is your healthiest rhythm. And so you can take that quiz at RebeccaLyons.com/quiz. And it's just 40 questions, 5 minutes, multiple choice. And you'll immediately get the response of what your natural rhythm is and ways to strengthen the other three.
So thank you for listening today. Take that quiz. Invite friends to listen to these conversations. Let's all keep going deeper together. Let's have more substantive conversation that are helping each of us grow and learn in the way that's going to help us flourish the most. So until next week, I hope you have a wonderful week.